Okay, so last time we were talking about virtualization, and we looked at different levels of virtualization: hardware level virtualization, OS level virtualization, application level virtualization. I will maybe next time I will actually show some of this to you. Okay, I couldn't get everything set up in time to give a quick demonstration of OS level virtualization and hardware level virtualization and whatnot. But I will try to do maybe a 5 to 10 minute overview next time on this. Okay. So, but today what I'm going to do is resume our discussion on distributed scheduling. Okay. So remember that two classes ago we started talking about distributed scheduling, which was basically the problem of you have a set of machines, you have a set of tasks. How do you decide which task runs on which machine? Okay. So we'll assume that tasks can be submitted to any machine, and then a scheduler on that machine or a global scheduler decides should that task execute there or should it be executing on some other machine. And it depends, and this decision really depends on the load on this machine as compared in relation to the load on other machines. If this machine is heavily loaded and others are not, you can move the task somewhere else. Okay? That is a discussion we had two classes ago, and then we basically did a bit of a digression and talked about virtualization. And there is a reason for that, as you will see in this class. So what I now want to talk about is actually code and process migration. This is basically the building block that is used to implement distributed scheduling. If you want to take a task and move it somewhere else, you fundamentally need the ability to move either the code or a process from one machine to another. Okay, otherwise, you will not be able to implement your distributed scheduler. Okay? So we are going to resume our discussion on distributed scheduling. But now that you also have the background on virtualization, towards the end of this class, I'll talk about how virtualization can simplify some of the tasks that arise in distributed scheduling. That's the reason we actually had this one class digression on virtualization. Okay. So goals for today's class is again understanding motivation for migration and trying to understand how migration occurs, and looking at one important issue is when code or process migrates, how does this application continue to access resources to which it had access on the old machine. Okay. So this is basically what we'll talk about. Okay. So again, motivation is performance and flexibility. We have already this background on distributed scheduling, so you know scenarios under which you might want to move an application or a task from one machine to another. Okay. So there are two types of migration techniques that we'll study here. One is called process migration, which is also synonymous for strong mobility. Another one is called code migration, which is also referred to as weak mobility. Okay? As the name suggests, in process migration, you are actually migrating an entire process that's already executing on a machine. Okay? There's a process, an application is already running. The process for this application, this process can be moved from one machine to another. Okay? As opposed to this, code migration basically just says that you will move the code and start a new process to execute the code. Okay, so you're not moving the process itself. No process is started. Maybe the user just submitted a command or started up an application. So what you do is you decide where this application is going to run, move the code to that machine and start the process there. Okay? As opposed to this, in process migration, you already have a running process that you have to migrate from one machine to another. Okay. There are examples of code migration. Okay. You probably have encountered code migration already in various contexts, but process migration you may or may not have seen in a system. So something as simple as form filling. Right? So you have a web browser, you are trying to do something and you are trying to fill a form on the web browser. Okay. Think of this as an example of code migration, because the server has actually sent some code to you, maybe some JavaScript code in a HTML page has actually come over to the browser. So the code has actually come to the browser and it's executing in the context of a browser. Okay? This is an example of code migration. It's a very simple example, but nevertheless, it's a valid example of code migration. In the context of databases, where you may actually have a query that you issue at a client machine. This query is actually sent off to the server. Okay? Query is actually a program. It's a piece of code that you are sending to the database server. So in this case, the code actually goes from the client to the server. Server executes the query, sends back the result. In the previous case, the form filling example, the code was actually coming from the server to the client, okay, and it was coming embedded in a web page, okay, as an example. Okay. Java applets are another example of code migration. Okay, so you have a web page, either a Java applet or embedded Flash. So these are all examples of code that the server is sending to you and it's executing in the browser. Okay. So what I'm trying to sort of point out here is there are scenarios that go beyond distributed scheduling in which process or code migration is useful. Our purpose here for studying this is to understand how distributed schedulers can make use of process and code migration, but there are other uses of it. That's the thing to keep in mind. Okay. The last point that is actually mentioned here is something as simple as a web search is also an example of a code migration because it's a query essentially you are specifying in the form of some free-form text keywords. That's sent off to the server. The server actually constructs a query using these keywords, executes it. Okay, another example. Okay. So we know about distributed scheduling already. That's the reason we are studying this topic in more detail. But here are some other scenarios where code migration can be useful. Okay. And this example basically says that you can dynamically configure a distributed system without having to pre-install all of the software. Okay, so suppose you have a large distributed system which has a number of components. Okay, rather than pre-installing every component on every machine, you just keep a lot of the components in a code repository. Okay, and in this case, it's a client-server distributed system, okay, but it doesn't have to be. So when the client is executing some application, if it tries to access some functionality for which it does not have code, and dynamically the server will send that code to you using from the code repository. So components can be downloaded and installed on the fly.
This is like JavaScript libraries in the browser.
Yes, so you can fetch JavaScript library. There are many examples of this. Okay? Dynamically fetching device drivers is an example of this. So if you install, let's say, plug in a new device, okay, your OS will try to search if there's a driver for it already. Maybe there isn't one installed. So then it can actually go and search an online repository and fetch code on the fly. Okay, and then install it, configure it, and start running it, and your device is ready to run. Okay, another example of code migration, and that falls into this category. Okay, not in the scheduling category, but in the sort of the flexibility aspect of it. Okay. So with that motivation in mind, let's try to understand various migration, various dimensions along which we can study this topic. Okay? So first, for our purpose, we'll assume that a process, every process includes several segments. Okay? And in particular, there is a code segment which consists of the code for that process. Okay? And there are data segments, of which there may be many, okay, that include the stack and the heap and whatnot. Okay? So think of any process as at least having two components, but many times there are more than two. Fundamentally, there's code for the process and data for the process. Data includes stack and the heap. Code includes the machine code that was generated from some higher level language. Okay? So keep this in mind. Okay, we'll look at this as we sort of, you need to understand that to understand some of the rest. Okay? So we already talked a little about weak versus strong mobility. Okay. In strong mobility, as I said, you have a process. At any point in the execution of the process, you are able to take that process and move it to another machine and resume execution of that process from exactly where you stopped on the previous machine. Okay. So a whole process moves. In weak mobility, okay, you are only moving code and it's essentially what's happening is you are starting a new process. So your program is starting from initial state. Okay. So there is no state to migrate. So in other words, what you need to keep in mind is in strong mobility, you are moving the code and the data. In weak mobility, you are only moving the code. Okay? And the data segment is created when the new process is instantiated on that machine. Okay? The other way to think about migration is whether it's sender or receiver initiated. Okay, in the sender initiated, the code is with the sender and the sender is sending the code to the receiver. So in this case, you client sending a query to the database server. Okay, the sender has the code, sends it off to the server, the server executes it. Okay? The receiver initiated is the other way around. You want to do something, someone is sending code to you. Okay? In the previous case, you want to achieve some task, you are sending some code to some other machine, that machine executes and sends the result. Okay, receiver initiated Java applets or JavaScript, the receiver initiated. Okay, you want to view a web page, server sends you some code that you execute, and then you see the web. It could be Flash animation, Java applets, JavaScript, any of these things. Okay. So the final dimension is who is going to execute, or where is the migrated entity executing. Typically in code migration, since you're only sending the code over, you typically start a new process. Okay, the code basically allows you to instantiate a new process and the new process executes the code. But that is not always the case. Okay, the code that is sent over could execute in the context of an existing process. Okay, example of this are applets, yeah, or Flash animation. So the browser is already a process that's running. Okay, some new code arrives and this code executes in the context of the browser. Okay, maybe new thread start up, maybe something happens, but you are not starting a new process to do this. Okay, so point to keep in mind is even in code migration, the code that's coming over need not execute in a new process. It could execute in some existing process. Okay, in process migration, almost always the same process is moving over and you're resuming execution on a new machine. Okay, this could be achieved in a number of ways. One is called remote cloning, which basically says that you just clone the process and then it starts somewhere else. Cloning is equivalent to a remote fork. Okay? On a typical Unix system, there's a system called fork that allows you to create an exact replica of this process. Okay? There is a child process that gets created, there's an exact copy of the parent process. Okay? This is called fork, and in Linux there's a system called clone, which essentially does this same thing. Okay? Think of process migration as a remote fork, where a parent actually forks off a child but on a different machine. An exact copy of this process is created and the parent terminates itself and the child continues execution. This is one way to think of how process migration could be achieved. Okay? If you had this notion of a remote fork. Okay? The other way is you basically suspend execution of the process. You physically transfer the memory state and disk state, if any. You load that state on this other machine, okay, and then you tell the kernel that here is a new process, so initialize whatever data structure you need to initialize, and you resume execution. Okay, this is called migrating the process. Okay? So these are two ways by which you can actually achieve process migration. We'll look at this in more detail. Yes?
So process migration, couldn't you be sending like gigabytes upon gigabytes of data? Like if you're sending files and RAM and...
Right. So you are at least sending the contents of RAM. Okay? Whether you send files that the process is executing, we'll see in just one moment. Okay? How do you handle resources? The RAM that is allocated to a process could be large, could be on order of hundreds of megabytes or gigabytes. So process migration by no means is cheap. Okay? So you have to, which is why when I talked about distributed scheduling, I said before you decide to transfer an existing process, you better be convinced that the cost is well worth the performance benefit you are going to get. Okay, so it's going to be a significant cost, as you have pointed out. There's a significant amount of data that needs to be copied over, okay, memory data or files as well. Okay. But there's another, so this is just showing various ways to classify mobility mechanism, strong versus weak. So this is process migration, code migration. Who initiates? Does the sender initiate the migration or the receiver initiate the migration? And how is it handled? You execute in the new process, you execute in the target process, whoever initiated it. Here you have to migrate the process or clone the process. You just take capturing what's on the previous slides in a figure. But the important issue that one needs to think about is it's fine to say this process is moving and the memory state is moving, but what happens to the resources that this process was accessing? Okay? Suppose this process had three files open on the local disk. Okay? You moved the process over. Okay? That's a different file system there. It's not the same one. What happens to the files here? How does it continue to get access? If you don't deal with these issues, this process is not going to work as you had thought it would. So the important issue is what happens to resources that any process that was migrating, Okay? Or for that matter, if even in the case of weak mobility, if you are migrating code, okay, so the code might be accessing some resources when you start it up. Okay? How do you ensure that code actually gets access to those resources even if you are executing on some arbitrary or a remote machine? Okay? That's an important issue to keep in mind. Okay, same is true of network state. If you had open sockets, okay, you are doing network communication, you had open socket, you just moved this process somewhere else. Okay? That machine has a different IP address. Okay, whoever was communicating with this process does not know process has moved. It will continue to send all of its requests or communication to the old machine. Okay? The process is somewhere else. Okay? The whoever was communicating doesn't know it has moved. So network communication can break. Okay? Any files or disk I/O that was being carried out can break if you don't deal with these issues carefully. Okay? Here I'm not going to talk about how to handle network communication. We'll come back to that in a later class. But I will talk about handling other resources, okay, disks, files, databases and whatnot. Okay? So to understand what to do, okay, I mean there are only two things you can do so that the process continues to get access to this resource. Either the resources have to move with the process, okay, or you have to provide remote access to the resource. So these are the only two ways you can solve this problem. Okay. If the process was accessing resources and the process moves, you move the resources. If you cannot move the resources or it's expensive to move, you somehow keep the resources where they are, but the process gets remote access. Although it's on a different machine, it can continue to access those resources. Okay. This is how you are going to address the issue. Okay. But to understand which of the options to choose under which scenario, we will try to classify various scenarios. Okay. First is, how are you accessing resources? Okay. You can access a resource by identifier, by value, and by type. Okay. By identifier, this means you basically have an identifier that precisely tells you which resource you are interested in. You are only interested in that resource, nothing else. Okay. And you have an identifier that identifies the resource. Typical identifier may be a URL. Okay, is an identifier, just as an example. Okay. So if a process specifies a URL, that's what it wants access to, nothing else. Okay. It may be in the name of a machine, is another identifier. Okay. The process wants access to the machine in some form, let's say it's an FTP server or some such thing. That's the resource. Okay. That's how you specified it. Okay. So there's a very tight coupling between what you want to access and what resource it is. Okay, and the coupling actually gets weaker as we go down this list. So by value, basically just says that I specify the name of a value of a library or a file name or some such thing, but I don't care which specific resource it is. So for instance, I can say that I need access to the Java libraries for this application to run, or I need access to the C library. Okay. Any copy of the Java library is fine. Okay. If you have Java 1.x, that's okay. Okay. And so some other machine may also have Java 1.x. So these copies are interchangeable. Okay. So if the other machine has those libraries installed, you can just use those. Okay. In other words, coupling has gotten weak. You are not saying I want a library that's installed on that machine and that machine only. Any library would do, so long as I have access to it. Okay. So that's what by value means. Okay. And by type, the coupling gets even weaker. Okay. So you may say, I need to print. This application needs to print. You don't care whether it's HP printer, Canon printer, or not. You just want to print to a printer, right? So long as a printer on the machine, you are fine. Okay. So this is even weaker coupling. Here you have a Java library. You can't substitute it by C library, for instance. Okay. So you want something very specific, but it's interchangeable. Here there's even weaker coupling. You just say, I want this class of resource. Okay. I want a resource of the type printer. Okay. It doesn't matter what exact type of printer it is. Okay. So what we are trying to point out here is there may be different types of resources you want to access. Okay. From the very specific to the very general. And depending on what you are trying to do, resources may or may not have to move. Okay. So that's something to keep in mind. Okay. And the second dimension is how expensive is it to move the resource if you want to consider moving it. Okay? And that basically says if a resource is unattached, that means it is cheap to move. It is not attached to any particular node. Files are a good example of that. You could move the file if you wanted to. It's not attached to a specific node. Okay? So those are called unattached resources. Fastened resources are resources that can move but at a high cost. So these could be thought of as large files as an example. So a database may be an example of a fastened resource. You could move the database, but it may be fairly large and it may be expensive to move. Okay? So which means that there is some affinity to not moving the resource. You want to keep it on that old node if possible. Okay? And the last type of resource is a fixed resource. This is a resource that cannot move. This could be hardware resources, communication endpoints, for instance. If it's a printer is not going to migrate with the process. It cannot move fundamentally. So this is far fixed. It's attached to the machine. Okay? There's nothing you can do to move it. So we'll see this table that basically has what is the process to resource binding. Are you trying to access a resource by identifier value or type? And what is the type of resource? Is it unattached? Is it fastened? Or is it fixed? And depending on which combination you pick, you have some set of choices. Okay? And typically the choices are as follows. So you could either decide to move or copy the resource. Okay? So those are the two choices here. Okay. You could establish what's called a global system-wide reference. This essentially means you access the resource remotely. Okay. Resource doesn't move. Resource stays where it is. You just get remote access to the resource. Okay. Or you rebind, meaning you just find a different resource of the same category and you are willing to use that resource on the local machine. So these are the choices. Move the resource, rebind to the resource, get remote access to the old resource. Okay. That's a question. Okay. So now what would you do? Right? So if the resource is typically unattached, regardless of whether it is by you are trying to access it by identifier value or type, since it is not attached, it's feasible to move or copy the resource. Yes, typically that is what you will do. Okay? But if the binding is very weak, there is no reason even to move it. If it's just by type, just rebind, find a local resource that will do the job and just use that resource. So don't even pay the price of moving it. Okay. So you can do move or copy, but there are other choices also. Okay, but this would be the preferred choice.
Why can't you copy something by identifier?
Why can you not copy by identifier? Because there is only one resource and one resource only. Okay. If you make a copy, then there are two copies of that resource. So then the identifier cannot tell you which are the two copies you're accessing or trying to access.
Local copy and the actual identifier.
Right. So point is, if it is if it's something like a website, okay, you don't want two copies, because if one gets modified, there are all these consistency problems that also arise, right? So we haven't talked about them as yet. We'll come to that in a later class. Okay. So you typically don't want to copy if you can avoid it. Moving is always better. Okay. Because if you have multiple copies are modified, then they go out of sync. Okay, if it's a fastened resource, fastened means it's expensive to copy, you typically not want to copy the resource or move the resource. You want remote access to the resource. So this column basically says try to get remote access, which is establish a global system-wide reference, which essentially means resource stays where it is. There's some way for me to access it from a different machine. Okay, if it's a file, you have a network file system that allows you to mount a volume and continue accessing the file. Okay. If it's a printer, you make it a network printer, so I can print from a remote machine, as an example. Okay, so you basically continue to get access to that resource even though you are not local to the machine. Okay. Again, if it's by type, you try not to even do that. If you find a local resource that does the job, you rebind. But you can also do these other two actions. Okay. And if the resource is fixed, which means it cannot move at all, then basically your choices are only remote access. Okay. Here you could have moved it, but at a high cost, for instance. But here there is no way to even move it, so the only choice is to continue to provide remote access. Okay. So that's basically what the table is saying. I mean, it's very intuitive at the end of the day. It's basically saying, can I move the resource? Can I get remote access to the resource? Or should I use a different resource instead? If it's a library, and there's a C library installed here, it's not the same file as there, but it's an equivalent file, I just use this one. Okay. So that's rebinding. Is this clear? Any questions on this?
File systems are different. Moving the resources might not be usable by the other system having different file systems.
So I'm not following the question. The file system is different.
Yeah, and you move how yes. how the system does different file systems when you use the same resource?
Is the process that is trying to access the resource. Okay. So let's say it's a database. And this is the process is a database server. Okay. So there are the files in the database and there's a process which is the server that's accessing those files. Let's say you move the process over. Okay. So then the question is, do you move the data or not? Okay. If you move the data, then it continues to get access to those files locally. So it has really nothing to do with the file system on that machine. So just whether the data is moved. So these are basically high level abstract discussion. You have to deal with if there are differences in platform architectures and so on. You have to deal with those things. But at abstract level, it's possible. Yes.
How do you know whether it's better to remote binding or to copy if you don't know how much use the actual local machine is going to have of that file? Like obviously, even if it's a fastened data resource, yep. if the client is using a lot, you might just want to move it.
Yep.
And if it only wants one little reference, you might just transfer that one reference.
That's a good point. So basic question is, if you have a choice between moving and getting remote access, okay? If you move it, you pay the price, or copy it for that matter, you pay the price of moving it. But from that point on, all accesses are local. The performance is enhanced, less network traffic. Okay. But if you continue to do remote access, then you will have slower read and write requests because you have to go over a network instead of writing locally. Okay. So question is how do you pick? Okay. And to do that, you need to understand what the application is trying to do fundamentally. If you know something about the application, saying, yes, this application is going to do lots and lots of I/O. Okay. So then you say, I am going to pay the price of moving it, although it's going to be a high cost, initial cost. Subsequently, there is going to be a big gain. If you don't know, you are better off not taking the risk, as an example. But this is really application dependent. The application developer knows, and you can specify something into to the distributed scheduler so it understands what to do. Okay? Okay. So the last point here is migration in heterogeneous systems. This was actually related to the point that was just raised. Okay. So thus far we assume that any migration, process migration or code migration, is essentially occurring in a homogeneous system. Same platform, same hardware, same operating system, so things are fine. Okay. But what if the source platform and the target platform are not identical? Either the OS is different, okay. Let's say they are both Intel, but the code was residing on Windows and now it's coming out to a Linux box. Okay. Or even the underlying architecture is different. Maybe this is a RISC architecture and that's an x86 architecture. Okay. Can process migration and code, how does code and process migration work in this context? Okay. Clearly the differences in software platforms and hardware architectures complicate migration. Okay. That should be clear. Okay. Because now you have to deal with additional problems. Okay. But it is simpler to deal with if you have weak mobility and if you have strong mobility. Okay. In weak mobility, you are moving the code and then starting a new process. In strong mobility, you are actually moving a process that's already executing in memory. Okay. Now, if you move it to a different hardware architecture, you have a problem. Okay. So there are ways to deal with it. Okay. So in weak mobility, what you can do is, if these are scripts, for instance, okay, you can recompile them to the underlying machine architecture of this is intermediate code. Okay. Java bytecode as opposed to machine code, you can move the code, then you can generate machine code and execute it. Okay. So some forms of weak mobility will work even if the systems to which you are migrating to are heterogeneous as compared to the source system. Okay. Strong mobility is much harder. Okay. In strong mobility, you have basically the code segment and the data segment, both have to move. Code segment is already machine code. So, you can't just execute it somewhere else as is without doing something. Okay. Data segment can be moved, okay, but then if the underlying machine architecture goes from little Indian to big Indian, you have to do appropriate translation. So, it's fairly non-trivial to do. Okay. So, in the case of code segment, you can do things like if you had the source code, you recompile it or something like this can be done. Okay. Or you use dynamic translation. This is why I had presented the virtualization material. So if you have an emulator, okay, you can move the thing, but then you run things in an emulator. Yeah, so as far as the process is concerned, it thinks it's running on the old architecture, but the emulator is masking all of the differences for you. Okay? Fundamentally, this is what's happening in Java. Right? Because Java is programs executed in JVM, which is an abstract representation of a machine, not a physical representation of any particular machine. We can freely move Java code around. Okay, so long as that there is a JVM, what is the underlying architecture is immaterial to you. It's running on the JVM, which is an abstract representation of a machine. Okay? So Java code can be moved regardless of whether the architecture is heterogeneous or not. Okay? For both process and code migration, doesn't matter. Okay? Is this clear? So what happens when you migrate? So what this figure is actually showing is how you would take the code segment and translate it and so on. That's not really important for us. What is important is how are the differences in hardware architectures are masked. Either you have to recompile or you have to run on emulators so that the underlying differences are masked, or you assume that your code is basically running on an abstract machine, which is could be a JVM. Okay? If these are scripts, for instance, weak mobility is simple. Okay? If it's a shell script or a Perl script or a Python script, you have the actual code, you can move it somewhere else and then execute the script either in an interpreter or you can compile it, recompile it. Okay? So that also makes it easier. The processes are harder. There is one form of migration in heterogeneous system. Another way to mask this is to actually do migration at a different level altogether. Okay? Not migrate code or a process, but migrate an entire machine. Okay? So what that means is you migrate both the operating system that was running as well as all of the processes on that machine. So you take a whole machine, move to another physical server and execute the whole thing. Yeah. Okay? Now this is feasible only if virtual machines are used. Okay? Typically. Okay? There are other ways to do it, but it's much simpler if virtual machines are used. So you take the virtual machine image, memory snapshot, move it somewhere else and you execute it in another virtual machine. Okay? Because the virtual machine abstraction remains the same, it doesn't matter from the perspective of the old VM that's now running on a different physical machine. Okay? It doesn't know that it's even moved for that matter. Okay. So this is called virtual machine migration. Okay. This is many virtual machine platforms already support this. Okay. It's a way to simplify your process migration. Okay. Most operating systems don't have support for process migration. You can't take a running process, suspend it and start it somewhere else. Okay. There are specialized systems that do this, but most OSs don't do this. The only way to do this easily is to take advantage of virtualization and you move the virtual machine and any important process that's in there that you wanted to migrate. This you can do today, okay, with existing virtualization platforms. Okay. Not only can you do this, there are techniques to do this without even suspending the application. Okay, the application continues to run, okay, and the migration process is started. And at some point, the application magically just jumps from one machine to another without any perceived downtime at all. Okay. This is referred to as live migration. Okay. The process is running live, the migration is taking place. Typically, all of the migration techniques we have assume that you first suspend the process, then you move the state and you resume execution. Okay. If you can do this without even suspending the process, then that makes it a little more attractive from an application standpoint. There is no downtime whatsoever. Okay. The way this, there are some details of how this works. So, just to give you an example, so the way migration works is suppose you have server 1, it has a hypervisor, it has a virtual machine running on this, and this could be running Linux as some processes that are executing. Okay. The way you would actually do migration is, so this resides in the RAM of this machine. Right? So the way you actually move it is let the VM continue to execute, because the processes are executing, they are changing memory state and so on. But then you take page by, look at all the pages of this virtual machine and send them over one at a time. Okay? So you basically scan through the memory and take each page and send it over the network. And the pages basically start appearing on this new machine. Okay? So you finish one iteration of this. Okay? Now, you are sent the memory state once over. Okay, but while you are sending this, since processes are continuing to execute, they may go and modify some memory state. They may write to memory variables, new processes may start. So the contents of pages are changing as memory is actually being transferred. Okay. So you do this iteratively. Okay. So in the second scan, you only look at pages that were modified since the previous scan and only send those pages over. Okay. So then you'll basically, let's say this page and this page and some other page are modified. So in the second time around, you'll only send these three. And you continue to do this. So the hope is that with each iteration, there's fewer and fewer pages you have to resend. Yeah, the first time around, you might send maybe 4 GB of RAM over. Okay, then of that 4 GB, maybe 300 megabytes were modified as you are sending it. So next time around, you'll send those 300 megabytes only. The rest doesn't change. Okay, so that takes less time to send an initial round. And while you do this, some more pages change. So you continue to do this until you reach a point where the amount of memory that has changed is very little. At that point, you will do a small pause of the virtual machine, meaning you actually stop executing the virtual machine, send that memory over. And now the two the virtual machines are in sync. They have exactly identical memory contents. Okay. So then you just terminate this VM and start executing that VM. Okay. This is in the abstract how you can actually transfer memory state. Okay. And this is completely, because this is happening while processes are executing, this is called live migration. So there is no suspension of any process. It continues to run. At some point, there's some instantaneous switchover. This VM stops executing here, it appears somewhere else. Okay. Nothing has changed as far as the VM is concerned, not even its IP address. Because the whole OS has actually moved over. All network connections have moved over. Everything is just the whole VM has moved, including its IP address, all socket buffers, everything has moved. Okay, so this makes the network part of it, which we hadn't talked about, also simple, because everything moves. Okay. There's a question there. Yes.
Well, this might never terminate because sending a page can take a while and
they
could dirty plenty of pages in the time it's transferring.
Yes. So this may not terminate, as you point out, because as you keep sending, if you start dirtying pages at a rate faster than you can send, this is obviously not going to terminate. The typical assumption is you can send at a rate faster than you can dirty pages.
You can dirty directly to memory. That's like...
Yes. So you can indeed do that. But so what the virtual machines do is they will try for some number of iteration, but there's a max limit. If at that point you just pause the VM and transfer the rest of memory over. So the hope is in the subsequent n iterations, the number of pages that you have to send has kept shrinking. Okay? But it may not, as you point out. So if there's a process that is dirtying pages faster than you can modify, then when you pause the virtual machine, you have to send more memory over than you would have otherwise. So the pause time will be perceptible. Typically, pause times are in the order of milliseconds, so you don't even see it. Okay, so it sort of switches over from one machine to another in a matter of a few milliseconds. But if the amount of memory that you have to send over in this last round is large, because pages were dirtied at a high rate, then that pause time becomes longer. Okay? Nevertheless, it will work, just that there will be a bigger pause in the application. Okay, the idea is to keep it as small as possible because you are doing what is called live migration. It's almost imperceptible switchover. Okay? The important thing, as I was pointing out, to keep in mind is that nothing has changed as far as the VM, although it's now on a different machine altogether. Even its IP address, all the socket state is basically some set of buffers, socket buffers in the kernel's address space. Everything has moved over as is, so nothing has changed from a process standpoint at all. Okay, there was some question. Yes, we have a question.
Couple high mobility and low mobility, like we take whatever the state of the process is and the code that has not been executed and migrate it to the new virtual machine and
yes,
start executing.
Code of the process, and
rather than shifting whenever something is executed the pages,
Yes.
The pages that were not, the code that was not executable, that was also shifted coupled with the pages.
Right. But I mean, all you know at this level is processes. Okay, these are just memory pages. If what you are saying has to happen, you have to actually understand the semantics of a process and then try to move the process over and resume its execution at some other point in time. You still have to move the data of the segments of the process, because otherwise you will not be able to resume execution. Okay? To avoid all of this, I mean, this is a completely independent technique that doesn't depend on what the process is, in what language it was written, nothing matters. It is sending memory pages, which is bits, over. And when you send all the bits and this set of memory pages and this set of memory pages are identical, it effectively says that I took whatever was in RAM here and now it has appeared in RAM there. I just continue execution, including the register state. Everything moves over. Right? So it is being done at a level that is even below the OS. Even the OS doesn't know things are moving. So it is completely transparent. That's the advantage of doing this. Right. If you want to do anything else, you have to understand the semantics of what's running here, in there. Okay, that's the difference between simplicity and yes, you had a question there.
So you said you could transfer a socket over and a connection over, but that would be fine for the computer you transfer to. What about the computer you're communicating with? Like now, that computer has to say, oh, I'm now supposed to be communicating with this one.
Yeah, so that's a good point. I was not going to actually look. Talk about that in detail here, but let me, since you asked the question, say exactly what has happened, right? So let's assume you have a cluster of machines. Right? So one assumption that I did not mention is right now this is only working on a local area network. Okay? On a wide area network, there are some additional complications. Okay? So let's assume there is a set of servers on a LAN. Okay? And then what that means is they are all connected by Ethernet. There's an Ethernet switch here. Then let's say there is some other remote machine. Okay, here is a VM. This is the, so let's say that's a server. Let's assume it's a web server. Here is a client. Okay. So you start this migration and this VM is actually moving here. So at some point in time, okay, when the migration is more or less done, all of these memory contents are moved here. Okay. So and then you may switch it over. And then this VM disappears and this VM basically appears here. So now your question is, what happens to any client that was actually talking to this? First of all, IP address has not changed. This is important to keep in mind. So as far as all routers are concerned, they will continue to send everything to this cluster. But the machine has actually moved from here to here. So only thing you really have to do is the switch needs to know that it has actually moved from here to here. Okay. So what this means is there is a Ethernet card here, the Ethernet card here. Okay. These are actually different Ethernet cards. They are different addresses. Okay. IP address hasn't changed, but the MAC address has changed. Okay. So you will do something called an ARP, which is rebind your IP address to a new MAC address after you move. Okay. So what that then tells the switch is that this IP address is now rebound to a different Ethernet address. So when packets for that IP address arrive, it will not send them here, it will just send them here. So as far as client is concerned, it doesn't know or care that this has happened. Okay? Because you are dealing with this at a LAN level. You are just saying this IP address is now bound to a new MAC address. So you have an ARP table, okay, that is the switch maintains, that says all packets for this IP address have to be sent to this MAC address. So that's how packets actually arrive here. So that mapping is changed. But the IP address hasn't changed, so nothing has to change in the routers. They continue to send this to this subdomain or whatever, so subnet, and everything else is fine.
So it's more complex if they're connected over a WAN.
Yeah, if you're connected over a WAN, then routing information has to change, because this might actually appear on some other subnet altogether. Keeping the IP address unchanged is much harder in this case. So if I move from here to some other site, that doesn't have the same subnet. Here, because you're on a LAN, all of the subnet information, everything is the same. So it's much simpler in a LAN setting than in a WAN setting. Okay, is this clear? It is required some networking tricks which you have to deal with. Any questions on this? Okay, so I'm going to spend the next half hour doing three case studies and then giving some other background material on server design. Okay, so basically what we have done now is we have looked at the basic concept of distributed scheduling. Okay, so and then we have looked at how process and code migration works to enable distributed scheduling. So let's look at some systems that use this in some shape or form. Okay, again at the abstract level, distributed scheduling is the problem of I have some set of tasks that are arriving in the system, I have some number of machines, how do I map tasks to machines? Okay, that's what distributed scheduling does. Okay, so there are several different ways to instantiate this. Okay, so we look at the case studies to do this. First one is called Boeing. We had talked about SETI at home back in the first or second class, if you remember. So this is a system that is actually used to implement applications like SETI at home. So people also call this an internet scale operating system. Okay. So what happens here is the machines that are participating in this large system are volunteered machines. Okay. They are not machines that somebody has purchased and is using for something. So users can decide to volunteer their CPU cycles on their laptop or desktop to a larger application. So whenever you are not using your machine, the system can get access to cycles on your machine and send tasks to your machine. Whenever you start using the machine, tasks are stopped. This is a basic concept. So the idea is if you are out for lunch or you are away for the evening and your machine is, let's say, switched on, those cycles can be put to some use. Yeah, that's the basic idea. So here the scheduler is centralized. Okay, not a distributed scheduler, it's a centralized scheduler. Machines register, if you actually decide to participate, your machine needs to register with this centralized scheduler. And whenever your machine thinks it has become idle, and typically the way this is done is if your screen saver starts up, that's an example of your machine being idle. So that's when a screen saver would start up. Your machine would then contact the centralized scheduler saying, I am idle, send me some jobs. Okay. So in other words, it's a receiver initiated system. And the receiver feels that its load is zero, which means it's idling. It will contact a scheduler saying, send me some task. Okay, some task is sent over to do some computation, send the result. And then if you continue to be idle, you ask for the next task and so on and so forth. Okay. So basically what you need to use such a system is if you have a very large task, application, if you can chop it up into smaller pieces, then this makes good use of. So as machines come and go, you continue to make progress because the application is partitioned into lots of little pieces and each little piece can be sent off to a different machine to execute. Okay. Simple example of this is if you have a very large data set and you want to process the data set. Okay. So let's say this is you have a telescope that is just taking images. Okay. And you want to process maybe hundreds of thousands of images that were captured over a period of time. Okay. This is a highly parallel application. Each image can be processed in parallel. So that's your task. Every time a machine contacts you, send it an image or could be even part of an image and say process it, do something. Okay. Look for, let's say, a star exploding or if there is a comet in this picture or whatever you want to do with it.
Aliens.
Yeah, or aliens, sign form. Alien sign form, which is what SETI at home does. Okay. And then the application, this task is, goes off to this machine, it computes something and it sends back a result. Okay. This is how the application works. Okay. So it's a very different form of a distributed schedule. Okay. It is receiver initiated but it is centralized. This is clearly weak mobility, not strong mobility. You are not sending pieces. I mean, you are sending, in this case, data and maybe a script. To execute and then the task is executed and sent back. Okay, so weak mobility, centralized scheduler, receiver initiated.
So if it's not completed when the person comes back, it just trashes it?
Yeah. So if it's not complete, you just give up because there are lots and lots of machines participating. You resend to a new machine. Okay, so you retry. Even if it is complete, typically what you do is you actually send the same task to some number of machines because machines may be buggy. Right? I may have written a malicious code which says whatever task you send it, I'm going to send you a result which is zero. Right? So I cannot predict what the machine is. The machines are untrusted. So you have to recompute the results on some number of machines and vote and say take the majority results and that's the real result. because you're assuming that machines can be untrusted, they can do arbitrary things, either because they're buggy, malicious, and not trusted. Okay, so things like this can happen here. Okay, so BOINC basically is what does it stand for? Berkeley Internet Computing, some open internet computing. There's a website if you just want to go and take a look at it. So if you go here, right, so boinc.berkeley.edu, you will see how to use it. So you can have any type of machine, Windows, Mac, Linux, can decide which projects you want to participate, and you download and run the code. And this code only kicks in whenever your machine is idle, and depending on what project you are participating, you basically get code from that project. Okay, so you can have different projects. Each project is trying to do a different form of computation. Okay, so let's just take an example here. Let's see. Oh, not connected. Okay. Okay, so here is a machine that seems to have donated a lot of cycles. Okay, so what this pie chart is showing is what applications are running on this set of nodes. It's not one node, it's many. So there's SETI at home, and there is some grid computation, and then there is Milky Way at home, and some other astronomic application and whatnot. Okay, so easy way to get lot of cycles without paying for your own machines. Okay, because people are donating thinking it's for a good cause. Typically, if you want lots of cycles, if you needed 10,000 nodes to do your computation, you have to pay a lot of money to get those 10,000 nodes somehow. Okay, here all the cycles come to you for free. Okay, so you have to assume that this is a task that your end users or donating cycles will believe in. Like, I am willing to donate my cycles to this task. Okay, so that's one system. Another system is called Condo. Okay, that the BOINC system works on internet scale. It's a highly distributed system. Okay. Condo uses the same principle but within a local area network. Okay. Again, what happens is you download a piece of software that sits on your machine. Okay, and you try, whenever your machine becomes idle, the Condo code kicks in and it contacts a coordinator saying this machine is idle, send some jobs. Okay. And then some jobs come over, or maybe one task comes over, it starts executing, okay, and when it's done you go back to the coordinator and redo the same. Same principle applied to a LAN. Okay. The idea here is within an organization, if you have lots of desktops that are just sitting idle because people are away for the night or away for lunch, then let's make use of those cycles. Okay. So here you don't volunteer your resources. Some system administrator says it's company policy that your cycle should be put to good use for running company applications. Okay? So some piece of software is installed, and whenever you're not on your desk, so this thing kicks in and it does some background computation. When you come back to your desk, machine is handed back to you, the task stops. Okay? So and this is used for longer batch jobs, okay, rather than in BOINC. In the case of BOINC, you have fairly short jobs that are sent and then you compute a result and send back. Here you can use this to run long batch jobs, jobs that run for hours. Okay. Again, it's receiver initiated. You basically contact a centralized coordinator for jobs. Jobs are sent to you. Okay. Because you are running long jobs, okay, you cannot use weak mobility here. You have to actually use strong mobility. Because if the user comes back and you terminate the job, let's say you were away for lunch for an hour, okay, so your machine has actually done some computation for 1 hour. Let's say it's a 3 hour job. Okay. So 1 hour of computation has already been spent on this. You come back and you kill the job and restart, this whole hour of work is wasted. Okay. So what Condo does is actually also supports strong mobility, where you can suspend the process and send it back to the Condor coordinator, and when some other node contacts it for work, it actually sends this partially executed job back and it resumes execution. Okay. Clearly, to do this, it needs homogeneous systems. Okay. It cannot take Macs and Windows and Linux and all mix them up. Okay. If it is a cluster of Linux machines, they are all identical, then it can do this. Okay. It can actually suspend a job and resume execution. Okay. So in this case, mobility can be strong. Okay, it can also support weak mobility if you have heterogeneity, but you can actually do it. So you can suspend a job, migrate and resume. Right? Same idea, harness idle CPU cycles, but with the ability to resume computation. Okay, so you can run long running computation with short bursts of idle cycles, which was not possible in the previous case. So that's Kondo. Okay? This is a system that was built in Wisconsin maybe 15 years ago and it has evolved. Okay? And many large clusters use this, many organizations use this to harness idle cycles. Okay? Third case study is actually a different model altogether. And this is basically the cloud computing model. Okay? Here you actually pay for resources. Okay? In the previous two cases you are harnessing idle cycles. The assumption is there is no money to be paid. I mean, all machines are already there. Somebody has donated cycles, or you have decided that if cycles, there are idle cycles, you will use them. Okay? Another model is you actually pay for resources that you request. Okay? That's basically what a cloud computing model allows you to do. In this model, there is some cloud computing provider that has already set up a large cluster of machines. Okay. Maybe multiple clusters of machines, thousands or tens of thousands of machines that are available for rent by the hour. Okay. In EC2 you can rent for as little as 1 hour and you can pay as little as 10 cents an hour. So you can say I want a machine for 2 hours, you will pay 20 cents to get that machine for those 2 hours. Okay. So you can basically very fine grain renting. You can rent by the hour and you can rent as many machines as you want. Okay. So long as you are willing to pay for the cost, an hourly cost, you can rent. Yeah. So what happens here is users make requests saying I want a new machine. Okay. So you go to this EC2 coordinator and you ask for a machine. Okay. And then the coordinator figures out which physical servers are idle and it allocates resources on that machine. The way this is done is using virtual machines. Okay. So it will actually allocate a virtual machine on that system. Okay, and then it will give you that machine and then you can do whatever you want with that machine. Okay. So this is, things are not being done at the granularity of tasks or jobs. Here resources are allocated at granularity of machines. Users get full control of the machines they requested and then they start jobs manually on those machines. Okay. Is this clear what I just said? Okay. So centralized coordinator, this uses virtualization. Okay. You can start up new machines or terminate machines as needed. Okay. And whenever you start machines, you basically get root level access to your machine. Okay. This is a virtual machine, so giving root level access is not a problem. You aren't giving access to physical resources, you are giving access to logical virtual resources. Okay. So from a cloud provider standpoint, you could do arbitrary malicious things, but then they can shut you down by terminating your virtual machines if bad things happen. Okay, so they still retain control over their physical infrastructure.
Can you get the image back
before it terminates? Right, so just a question of the image. Let me come back to that in just 1 second. So think of this as a distributed scheduling on a cluster of servers where you are allocating an entire machine. Typically you submit job and the scheduler will say, okay, I'll run the job here. Here you do it at a lower level. You ask for machines, entire virtual machines are given to you and you run jobs in those machines yourself. Yeah, slightly different model. Also, this is you have to pay for resources. It's not coming to you for free. Yeah, so there's a question of image. Okay. So the way this typically works is when you ask for a virtual machine, you can specify an image saying, I want this machine to run Linux of this sort, and there are images that an image is copied over, a virtual image, and then that machine is booted there. Okay. So if you terminate typically this depends on the cloud platform, but if you typically terminate the machine, that image is gone. So if you want to save it, you have to explicitly save it before you terminate it. If you don't save it, then they will delete the image. But if you save it somewhere else, then you get access to that image. And then you can restart it at a later point. Okay. Any questions on this? So we have looked at several different flavors of distributed scheduling. There's one more I'm going to talk about. Which is a Planet Lab model, which also uses virtualization. Okay. So here you have a homogeneous cluster. Homogeneous as in you have a cluster that's installed by an organization. In this case, it happens to be Amazon The EC2 just says elastic computing cloud. Okay, that's what EC2 means. Okay, it's a cloud computing platform. There's another model that is also used where distributed scheduling is used. This is where researchers have donated a group of machines that are used to do some systems work, systems research. Okay. So it's a distributed cluster across universities. It's not owned by any single organization. So each university decides that it will put 3 machines on this cluster. Okay, it's called a Planet Lab cluster. Okay. On each of these machines, you basically run a virtualization layer. Okay. In this case, they are using OS level virtualization that we talked about last time. Okay. So this uses what's called Linux vServer. So you have Linux, and then you basically create containers. Okay. And each of them looks like a virtual server, where its processes are isolated from processes running in this container. So you can isolate across these containers. Okay, you are not running real sort of hardware level virtual machines, you are running OS level virtual machines. And the what this is used for is distributed systems research. Okay. So suppose you are doing some research on a system that you have built, and it has multiple components, a peer-to-peer system or a client-server system. You want to actually do experiments over the internet. How would you do this if you wanted to do something like this? So typically what you would have to do is, if you have a friend in some other university or somewhere else, you say, hey, give me a guest account. I want to run part of my application there. Part of the application runs here. I do some measurements and do some experiment. Okay? But if you needed 10 sites, you may not have 10 friends who are all willing to give you a guest account. That's basically what this distributed cluster is used for. If you donate machines to your cluster, you can get guest accounts on all other machines in the cluster. Okay, so if there are 300 universities or so that participate, you can actually get access to machines at 300 different sites across the globe. Okay, and then you can actually use those guest accounts to run whatever system you have built, do measurement studies and whatnot. Okay, that's the use of this distributed cluster. Now what is interesting to us is how the scheduling works. Because the reason we are doing this case study is the distributed scheduling aspect. So this also works like the Amazon model, but there is no payment involved. So you say you basically are given some resources in the entire distributed cluster. So for instance, let's say you can get 10 guests, up to 10 guest accounts at a time. So you can then say, I want guest accounts on 10 different sites, and the coordinator can either pick those sites, or you can specify saying, I want this site and this site. I want one in Europe, one in Asia, one here, just as an example. Or you say, I don't care, give me 10 accounts. So it will then figure out which machines have resources and allocate new vServers for it. It will create new containers. Just as EC2 created virtual machines, here it creates containers on machines located at the sites that it has chosen for you. And then it will give you login access to your container, and then you can log in and run whatever code you want. Okay? Again, it instantiates a virtual container, and you log in and you run your application. So you don't submit jobs, you ask for virtual machines. Okay? And then you run whatever jobs you want inside those virtual machines.
Can you configure the system requirement as you want, or is it just as a particular system which is there and it is just applicable?
System requirements meaning what? Hardware configuration?
Hardware, what is the system requirement for this? It should be compatible with my application.
So they all run Linux.
Yes.
Okay, so you can only run Linux, do Linux research with Linux system applications.
Can you say my software needs so much of space?
Yes.
Can you provide me only this
one? Yes. So when you ask for a container, you can specify the resource requirements of the container. This is referred to as a slice. Okay? So you want to run a research experiment. You ask for a slice. Slice says, oh, I need this much CPU cycles. I need this much display. I may need this much network bandwidth to run my application. And it will make sure those resources are available when it allocates you those slices. Okay? So that you can request. You cannot say, I want a Windows machine. In this case, it's all Linux based, for instance. So you cannot specify that, but you can specify how much resources you need on each node. And it will allocate a container with at least that much allocated. Any other questions? Okay, so there are 4 flavors of distributed scheduling things we looked at. There is this harness idle cycles over the internet, harness idle cycles within an organization, okay, and use centralized schedulers to do this. And we looked at two that are using virtualization to do scheduling of servers. In this case, you use real hardware level virtualization, schedule servers in a large cluster or what's called a data center. In the second case, you had a distributed cluster, you are harnessing cycles on that by allocating virtual server. Okay. So these are various instantiations of how distributed scheduling is used today. Okay. So in some cases, your process migration, other case your code migration, and still others you just get machines, you download your own code and you start it up. Okay. There is no code or process migration even supported in those systems. Okay. So these are the sort of the spectrum of systems that people have developed. Any questions on this? Okay, so that is the end of the material on process and code migration. And what I'm going to do now is actually I have maybe 3 or 4 slides on some server design issues that basically will wrap up this chapter. Okay, we started off by talking about threads and thread scheduling. We looked at distributed scheduling, we looked at virtualization, and then we looked at today various forms of distributed scheduling using process and code migration. Okay. So now just to put it all together, let's go back, take a step back and try to go back to this client-server model, okay, and start thinking about not scheduling, but what is the architecture of these servers that then can make use of all of these mechanisms that we have looked at so far. Okay. And some of this material is going to be useful for the first programming assignment. Yeah, that's going to be handed out maybe in a couple of weeks. Okay. So I talked a little bit about iterative and concurrent servers. Okay. Iterative, basically concurrent servers are multi-threaded servers. So we talked about this request per thread per request model. Every time a new request comes into your server, you start a new thread, that thread services that request thread is terminated, or you use this pool of requests. Okay. This is called concurrent servers. Okay. You may not have a multi-threaded server, you could choose to just have a single threaded server, which is called an iterative server. So in this case, a server just sits in a loop, requests that come in just join a queue, and the server basically takes a request at the front of the queue, processes it, and then loops. Okay, then takes the next request, processes it, and so on. No concurrency, but you still get the ability to service requests one at a time. Okay, that's so those are the two typical techniques one can use to design a server. Maybe the first server you will build for the app programming assignment may not be multi-threaded. But if you want to scale to larger number of requests, then you have to take it from here to here. Okay, this is something to keep in mind. Okay. Next question to think about is how to locate where the server is. A server may be running on a machine, but how should the client contact the server? Okay. Typically, there are various techniques used. One is the server could be listening on a well-known port number. Okay. So in case of HTTP, servers listen on port 80. Right. So if your browser wants to talk to any web server, all you need to specify is the machine name and it just contacts the server and on port 80. Okay. This is the socket ID or the socket number that is used. Okay, so that's the port number. So that's one way to do it. You use a well-known port. Okay. Another way to use this is what is called a directory service. Okay. In this case, you don't have a predefined port. What you do is when the server starts up, it goes and registers itself with a directory. Okay. And says, I am providing this service, I am listening on this port number. Any client wants to contact me, they should contact me on this port number. Okay. So before a client can talk to the server, it must do a directory lookup. Yes, it goes to the directory saying, is this service running? If so, what's the port number it's listening on? Then the directory lookup is then going to return a port number, and the client has the port number, it talks to that. Okay. Now to do this, you will probably realize that you have to ask the question, how do you contact the directory service? That's also a process running somewhere. So you have to at least assume that the directory service in this case is listening on a well-known port. You cannot look up the directory, you cannot figure out where your server is or services. Okay? So there are many directory services typically many of it, depending on which one you use, they have different well-known port numbers. So you can decide which one you want to use and pick that. That's the other way to. The last way to do this is what is called a super server. Okay, in the context of Unix, this is what's called INETD. Okay, the internet daemon. So what happens in this case is process doesn't start running. It started dynamically on the fly. You register with a higher level server. Okay, that is listening on a well-known port. Okay, use clients actually contact this super server and say, I'm interested in this service. And the super server dynamically starts up the process, binds it to a port and tells you, okay, now this is the server, this is the process, and this is the port it's listening on. Okay? In both of these cases, the service was already running and it was listening on a port, just had to find the port number. Yet another way is, why run the service if there are no clients? Start the server up only when a request comes in. If there are no outstanding requests, let's not consume CPU resource, shut the service down. So in this model, you need someone else to start up the service as requests come in. Okay, this is called a super server. Okay, so all other services register themselves with the super server. Whenever a client request comes in, it also specifies the type of service you are interested in. The super server actually starts a process for that service and then forwards the request to that process, and the process services it. Okay, that's basically this model. Okay. Typically in this class you probably will not use this. You might use this, and maybe you will use this, but this is actually used for well-known services like secure shell daemons and FTP daemons. They can be all started on the fly. Rather than having them run always in the background, you just start them up when needed. Okay. So another design aspect that you will have to think about when you design your applications are whether to keep state in your server or to make your server stateless. Okay. If your server keeps state about which clients are talking to it, what they are doing, this is referred to as a stateful server. Okay. On the other hand, if your server does not have any state about the clients, okay, it just services the request and then it's done. It doesn't keep in track of which request or service, what's happening. Then this is called a stateless server. Okay. And there are advantages and disadvantages of whether the server is stateful or not. In some cases, depending on the application needs, you may have to pick one or the other. Okay. Typical web servers, Apache or HTTP servers, by definition are stateless. Okay, they service an HTTP request. Okay. And once they are done, the connection terminates. There is no information kept about what the client was doing. All the client state is gone. Okay. Next request comes in, you service it, and you terminate the network connection, the TCP connection. Okay. That's a stateless server. Okay. Now, if on top of this web server, you write some application, let's say you write an online shopping application. Okay. And this application may then have to keep some client state. For instance, if you have a shopping cart, the client has actually browsed through a catalog and put some items in the cart. Okay. This is client-specific state that the server now has to keep track of. It can't, so even across requests, two successive requests from the client, this state has to be kept at the server. Right? So this makes the server stateful. Okay. So clearly, depending on what the application is, you might have to pick either a stateful or a stateless server. Now there are advantages and disadvantages again of both of these. Okay, stateful servers are more complex because they are keeping state. They are also less tolerant to crashes. If there is a crash of the server, when the server comes back up, when you restart the server, all the state that was maintained is gone because it is memory state. Right, so if there's a shopping cart and your web server crashes, memory state has disappeared. So when it comes back up, all of that is gone. Okay, so from a user standpoint, this is not a good thing. Okay, stateless server, by definition, don't keep any state. Okay, so all the state, if necessary, is kept at the client. You can implement a shopping cart even with a stateless server. The way you would do this, you would embed the contents of the shopping cart in a cookie and send it back to the browser. Okay, so when the client makes the next request, this cookie comes back to you, so you know what is in the cookie. Okay, now, if the client deletes the cookie, then you are in trouble, but assumption is this doesn't happen frequently. Okay. So you can decide what you want to do. Okay. There's a third technique called soft state, and this is basically a performance optimization. So if in a stateless server, you keep state for a limited amount of time and you throw it away afterwards. Okay. But you keep, whenever there are requests, when you have kept the state, you can optimize performance. This is often referred to as soft state. In a soft state server, the correctness of the application does not depend on whether there is state at the server or not. Only the performance of the application depends on whether there is state or not. State can always be regenerated if necessary. Right? But if it is cached, then you get performance benefits. It is often referred to as soft state. Yeah, and this is used to cache and improve performance. Most likely you will not use any soft state in this course. You will either use a stateful or a stateless server.
Also, state is typically stored in the form and
So by state we mean arbitrary things that are related to the client. This doesn't even have to be a web server, right? It could just be a simple two processes communicating over a socket, exchanging some messages, and depending on what messages we received, you may keep some state. Okay? In case of web-based application, you may have state. There could be forms that you have filled. There could be shopping carts you have used. Those are web-based applications, and that's very specific to web-based client-server apps. But in an arbitrary distributed system, you may not be using HTTP, you may be using some other protocol to communicate. So even in that case, you may have state.
Something like TCP.
I'm sorry? Most of the server will use TCP. But if you are just using plain vanilla socket communication, you just set up TCP sockets and then you just communicate, you define your message format, that's your own protocol. You are not using HTTP or something else. Okay. So even in this case, if there's a client and the client has made a request to a server, if you actually keep track of what that request was previously and you use that for processing subsequent requests, then you have maintained state by definition. Okay, so you know what the client has done until now. If you have that knowledge, you have state. If you don't know, each request is processed and then there's no track, you don't keep track of what requests your server, then you have stateless server. That's basically the abstract definition. Okay. And clearly, depending on what you are doing, you may have to have stateless or stateful. If the interaction has to be tracked, so you need to know what has been done in the past to process this request, you have a stateful server. If not, if each request is independent, you have a stateless server. Okay. So since we have run out of time, let's just stop here. There are a couple of slides I will talk about next time. Just a reminder, there is a homework that is due tomorrow. Okay. So the way to submit it is to go to Spark and upload your homework. Okay. If you have any problems or questions, come and see me.
So you select the homework, then you go to the text field, paste the homework and submit?
Paste the homework or just upload a file if you want to. I think it allows you to upload files.